This is The Platform Rules, digital transformation for product companies, hosted by Propel Software. Forrester's principal analyst, George Lori, joins Propel CEO, Ross Meyercord, with an incisive report about the implications of AI in the manufacturing industry, including real-world examples of how processes and product design are being revolutionized. Before we begin, we'd like to say thanks for joining us this season, and we'll be back again in 2024 with brand new episodes of The Platform Rules. Now, without further ado, here's Ross.
Welcome, everybody. I am Ross Meyercord. I am the CEO for Propel Software, and we'll be co-hosting the session here today. And our session is Delivering PLM Success in an AI-Obsessed World. Who better to help us really unpack this topic than George Lowry, who is one of the lead PLM analysts at Forrester. So with that, George, I'll pass it over to you. And I know we'll run through some content with you, and then you and I can go through some question and answer discussions here after your presentation.
That's great, Ross. Thanks for the introduction. And thanks, everybody, for joining. As Ross says, I'm one of the analysts at Forrester looking at PLM. I'm the author of the two most recent PLM waves that we did earlier this year and one in 2021. And I've been at Forrester now for 20 years. Before I joined, I was in consulting. And before that, I had the honor, really, to be a controller in a manufacturing group. So manufacturing is a thing I really love. And I was very taken with some of the things that PLM can do now that we couldn't do back then. In this short session, I'm going to, first of all, share some data. Forrester's really, I suppose, more famous for collecting data than anything else. And I want this data to be valuable to you. So I'm going to share some data about what's happening in the PLM market. I'm going to try and then explain why it's changing, why it's on the cusp. And I think Russ has stolen my thunder a little bit because it is indeed related to injecting AI into everything. And I then want to spend a little bit of time exploring the opportunities that you have integrating quality in PLM. So what does that really mean, particularly for regulated industries like life sciences? And then I want to look at what it means to integrate with the sales and marketing process as well, because there's a massive lost opportunity there for most companies racing to market with new products and maybe not establishing the groundwork that they need, the foundation to win those sales right at the beginning. And finally, I'm going to be very cheeky and make some recommendations to you, but they're recommendations based on work that we've done with our clients. So I'm going to start by looking at what's happening in this PLM market. So we ran this at the end of last year. We surveyed different PLM users, and the thing that really should jump out to you is that almost half of PLM users are planning to replace the platforms that they have. Now, it's partly, of course, because the platforms, some of them have been there a long time. They've customized them. They've got challenges around extending them to different parts of their business. But the real reason behind this is that the platforms themselves don't help them to integrate with other key processes. They maybe don't manage the verification and validation in the way that they need. They certainly don't manage the new requirements that there are around sustainability. And perhaps most worrying of all, they tend not to produce the content or produce the integration that people need for their sales channel and for their sales people. So why are almost half of them about to change is because those legacy applications, generally speaking, don't embed AI in these critical use cases. So when we work with our clients, some of the things that they talk to us about, they talk about how will AI augment their workforce in PLM. And many of you will be well aware of this around the fact that a lot of PLM is very, very labor intensive. And there's fantastic opportunities for AI to help them manage data more effectively. So what else might they be thinking about? They're thinking certainly about traceability and about reusability. We see this all the time, particularly with long lifecycle products. But we've seen it too with some shorter lifecycle products too, that people are thinking about How can they manage the reusability of parts? How can they understand what parts are out there in the supply chain? And if you're in the electronics business, you're certainly thinking about that and thinking what might be substitutes for the semiconductors I might have preferred to use. And can AI help me to identify those substitutes and to see how I might quickly change my design to accommodate them? So I talked already a little bit about data. The final thing I ought to just mention is the value of computer vision and AI in this inside PLM. So we've seen over and over again people using this perhaps to identify a part, perhaps to simulate what this product or this part would be like in assembly or in use. That said, AI and generative AI, those priorities have been driving cloud adoption. I don't think it's a big surprise that the additional computation that you need has been driving people. In fact, PLM had already moved to the cloud in order to help manage collaboration within the company, but also with suppliers and with customers. But what we're seeing now is that AI is driving an additional requirement for elastic computation. It's also driving the ingestion of many more different data sources, which are easy to ingest, to label, and to manage once you move to the cloud. And I should say that also those AI capabilities are beginning to differentiate the cloud providers. So we've seen a kind of early stage when it's been all about the technology. But now in the middle years, the hyperscalers are differentiating through the way that they tackle industry problems. And we're really at this stage now. So many of the cloud providers are embedding AI and embedding it to help you solve an industry problem. And that's critical, really, for people thinking about PLM. It's one of the reasons why many, up to half of people, as we said, are beginning to think about a change in their PLM provider. So I said something about what's happening with PLM. I want to talk a little bit about the state of PLM as well. We did a study earlier this year, actually, with around 12 different users of PLM to try and understand what drove value for them, what really was the return on investment for them. The critical thing here is that we found that, yes, time to market was important, but what really drove the time to market? It was building in quality from it every stage so that you weren't delayed in your launch by validation or verification concerns. And the second thing we found was it was driving content out of PLM so that you could collaborate with your customers, perhaps on requirements or stakeholders in your sales force and your distribution force. But it was also enabling to see what it would be like to simulate it, to understand what the experience of using would be like. So collaborating on requirements, but also sometimes on testing and sometimes being able to use this to generate early or first sales. So the study, just to summarize it, we found that integration with QMS accelerated time to market by reducing these delays. I think many of you would be aware of the kind of delays and the kind of stress that produces inside a company, as well as with its salespeople and its channels. It also boosted sourcing and supply chain, as well as design productivity, enabling them to reduce the management effort of supplier quality by up to 40%. In terms of design productivity, one of our interviewees for this project said that they're also having some level of demoralization with their engineers and designers because so much of their work that they had done was failing at the last stage and then having to be reworked. And that wasn't work, something they really wanted to do. But perhaps the most important number that comes out of this is that in this study, we found that PLM users could reduce their time to market from 27 months to 20 months for major projects and from 7 months to 5 months for average innovations. What does that mean? It means you get there before your competitors, and it means you accelerate your concept to cash cycle, which is critical for people in competitive innovation. So I want to talk a little bit more about the quality integration opportunity, and then we'll go on and look a bit more at sales and marketing. So quality, before we publish our waves that compare all the vendors, we look at the use cases, and we just discuss them with our readers and with our clients, and also with the vendors and systems integrators. And we found that quality was really one of the core PLM use cases. Why? Because for most of our clients, they're in some kind of validated market. So it might be automotive, aerospace, life science, perhaps, or high technology. And so what were they really looking for? They were looking to build in quality into the requirements management, into the design test and certification, into the product data that they actually were managing, and later on publishing about the products and perhaps sharing with potential customers and sales channels. We also found that actually inside the manufacturing use cases, which PLM usually supports as well, so when as designed, as manufactured, and as maintained, bill of material, and sometimes a bill of service as well, that there was a quality element to that, that by building in quality to each of these elements and not waiting until the end, that you were able to get to market quicker. And we think this is going to become much more important as compliance, sustainability, and green PLM management become more important. As people design products, to manage their scope 3 carbon footprint, but also to provide reusability and environmental friendliness. And you'll be well aware, there's a lot of legislation, a lot of regulation, which is on the cusp now of reaching us. So we've already had this for some time in Europe. We've had the REACH legislation. We've got for example, the German Supply Chain Due Diligence Act, and now it's a European one, the so-called Lieferkettengesetz, which means that you have to be sure that whatever you produce, wherever you're producing it and wherever you're sourcing it, you treat labor, but more importantly, you treat the environment in the same way that you would as if you were producing in Germany. This is a very difficult demand, a very tall order. People are building it into their PLM. So as they're designing the product, they're building in what's the impact on this compliance. And then if you look at, for example, North America, different Canadian provinces, even states have different PFAS regulations. So this is a really important part of being able to get to market. Compliance is with a compliant and sellable, sustainable product. You've got to build that into your PLM. One of the things that we did towards the end of 2022, we surveyed Fortune 200 executive to understand what they were doing about sustainability. And you can see that 61% of them had already named some kind of sustainability lead. I think one of the things that jumped out for me quite a lot was the scope 3 carbon footprint, the number of them who had an emissions reduction target already in there. And that, if I remember correctly, was double what we had when we ran the same survey in 2020. So you can see how important this is to the largest companies, that sustainability initiatives are reshaping PLM. So where we used to look at just, let's say, cost and performance, we're now looking at cost, performance, and sustainability as part of whatever we design. So I talked there a little bit about the importance of quality and quality integration. I want to go on and talk a little bit about the opportunity cost, or the risk, the lost opportunity that you have when you can't integrate sales and marketing easily to PLM. And again, when we were doing our initial landscape work before we published the wave, we found that sales and marketing are important extended use cases for PLM. So yeah, we've got service use cases, of course, but note the sales and marketing use case there. What's it all about? It's support for engagement of the wider enterprise. And I talked already about people in sales and in marketing, but also for people in our channel partners as well. So providing them an ability to have accurate data about what this product, the components, the materials are that are in there, but also what will it look like? What will it be like to use? So all that is very important to try and win your first customer, perhaps before you've even finished producing the product. Interestingly, we conducted this survey as well last year. We did this on behalf of a client, And we surveyed engineering leaders to understand what were they really worried about. And the thing that interested me most here was to find that they were most worried about trying to stay competitive. And what did it mean for them staying competitive? It meant, yes, being compliant, but it meant the speed with which they could get the first examples or first instances of their product sold and out there in the market. And for them, it was very important for them to be able to integrate PLM with, if not with their customers, at least with stakeholders of their customers. So people in sales and marketing and people in their channel partnerships. Now, modern product lifecycle management also enables new business models, and particularly in healthcare, new healthcare experiences. So we've been thinking a lot about this with our clients, about how does a modern product management, product lifecycle management solution, how does it help you to explore what kind of different sources of value there might be? And you can't do that if you can't connect your PLM to your sales and marketing and to your, basically to your CRM efforts. Most interestingly, this was something that our life sciences clients talked about a lot, the ability to introduce more proactive monitoring, which perhaps wouldn't have occurred just from an engineering perspective, but was very prominent in the minds of their customers and their customers' customers. How were they able to discover this? By sharing early data about, this is what we're looking at, here's what the product might be like, what else could we do to make it more valuable, what software could we embed, how might we connect it, what sensors ought it to have, and then how might you use that? How might you use it for monitoring, for example? This is an example of monitoring health at home. So that kind of thing is really it to get your first instances, and to have a successful product launch, it's all about connecting with the customers or stakeholders of the customers. And it's really why when we look at smart manufacturing generally, PLM or modern PLM is right at the heart of it. We always say it's taken the elevator from the research and development basement to the C-suite. And it's AI that's helped it to do that, and connection with the market and the customer and customer stakeholders. Well, let's talk a little bit more about how you do this connection. I think the important thing is that content matters to sales channels. So even in the most arcane and scientific and specialist products, we have found, and we've done this through research and through projects with our clients, that the buyers, or more likely the specifiers, are always looking online. They've always understood something about your product or your capability long, long, long before your engineers or your sales engineers call them. And so it's really critical to manage that content and to manage what they see and to make sure that it's accurate and to make sure it's compelling and convincing. And really, this is something that we think about a lot, that the experience that they have, those people who are not yet buyers, who are prospects, the experience has got to fit their context, which means you need all the data. So sometimes it's going to be really technical data. We did some work with somebody around specialty chemicals and glass. Yes, it was about very technical data, but it was also about what might the colors look like? So they were looking for really, I'd say sort of, a visual or an immersive experience as well. So this is what we think about with commerce and content and value and the experience for those people who are not yet customers. So what do you need to do that? Well, PIM is an established technology that does this, product information management. But what's the top disruptor? It's AI capabilities that support ingestion, enrichment of lots of different data. And where is that data coming from? The best and most accurate data is coming from PLM. We have this all the time when we're thinking about any kind of labeling or description which has some kind of legal requirement. So you need PLM to keep the PIM, or I almost said honest, I crossed it out and said compelling, but honest as well. We have a lot of people who worry about this. Are we really publishing something that's, particularly in life sciences, where you're not supposed to publish anything that isn't verified by experiment and test? This is very important. So it's critical, really, your integration with your sales, your marketing, your channels, all that content should be coming out of PLM. And it's PLM itself that powers what we think of as a customer lifecycle. So that lifecycle, I talked a little bit about those people who might be discovering this. They're going to trip over it and find it on a website somewhere, actually more likely in a chat room. So you need to manage what gets into that chat room. They're then going to explore. They want to go a little bit deeper. So you've got to have a way of opening that PLM kimono, and you can't do that if you haven't got a good way of sharing it. So that's just, I'm not going to labor it too much, but that it's for our clients, this has been really critical. How do you get PLM and PLM in sync, PIM in sync, and how do you manage that so that it's a compelling experience for your prospects before they even become customers? And with that, I'm going to, if you don't mind, offer some recommendations about things you might want to do. So our clients, when they've been thinking about this, they've been starting off with a benchmark. They've been looking at what's their concept to cash cycle, what's their time to market compared with their peers. Because if you can change that, and if PLM can help you change it, that's going to make a big difference. How quickly can your sales channels or your, let's say, your customer stakeholders, how can they test cost concepts? So going back to that healthcare at home, it was possible for them to test it digitally before they had to make any kind of model and give it to anybody. And this is the thing you can see in consumer goods already. People are doing it all the time. Recruit a digital panel, test it, then have different features. You can do this in the B2B world if your PLM enables you or helps you to do it. Another thing you might do, some of our clients have hurt a lot from this, is what's the delay in time to market because there's some kind of certification latency. What happens when you get to the end of it and whoever's certifying it says, no, you've got to go back to the beginning. What does that do to your designers? How demoralized are they? But more worryingly, what does it do to your impact on the market? And then thinking about sustainability, how easily can you prove provenance in your extended supply chain? How easily can you swap for a different semiconductor, which is available, from the one that is now no longer available? And then how can you quantify the opportunity of late stage design changes? We've seen this a lot. So everybody in this business, in the PLM business, knows about engineering change management. And yeah, it's hard when it's out in the field, but it's very disruptive when it's late stage in your product design or product launch lifecycle. So we've seen people quantify that as well and say, what can we do about that? And how can we do a better job around it? So in conclusion, really what I want to say, almost in conclusion, I've almost finished. I want to say that PLM, it's not something locked in the basement now. It's powering a customer-obsessed type of business. That customer-obsessed innovation, value to the customer and the customer's customer. Yes, it depends on the platform you have. It depends on the partnerships that you have, but also the practices that you embrace. So all of these solutions, yes, they need integration with different solutions. Yes, they need extensibility. Yes, they need built-in AI, not least around the UI and the experience for a very wide variety of different users. So not just engineers, but people, and not just people in procurement, but people now in perhaps in your channels, perhaps even directly in your customers. So all of that needs to be brought together.
George, that was fantastic. You know, every time, George, I get a chance to chat with you or read some of your content, I always learn so much. So really appreciate that. So George, I think now we're going to, you and I will kind of go here into and ask you some questions based on this. And if we have time at the end here, we'll take questions from folks in the audience. And George, if you want, you can stop sharing the presentation. So George, kind of first off, while you're sorting through that,
trying to figure that out. Yeah,
that's all right. No worries. So George, you know, one of the stats you showed here at the end that really struck me is, you know, from your research showed that 71%, if I got the number right, the engineering leaders feel the pressure to get to market faster and really stay competitive. But engineering leaders really aren't the only ones that are responsible for getting to market quickly. The pressure of reducing costs and navigating supply chain shortages and you know, streamlining business processes are kind of really enterprise-wide concerns. You know, how do you think modern PLM can reduce or eliminate kind of some of these more broadly?
Sorry, I was just trying to stop sharing. So talking about the 71% of engineering leaders, what can help them around that? Well, it's not just about design, test, and regulatory validation. We've seen lots of concern about the supply chain. We talked about that, particularly semiconductors. But what they really need to do is they've got to vigorously vet those materials and suppliers for quality and financial stability, ESG compliance, all that kind of thing. But what they really need is a platform that enables them to do that and to do it in a way that can incorporate the voice of customer feedback and try to secure sales in advance based on collaborative design and tests with selected customers. So you've got to have, the real thing is you've got to have supply chain, you've got to have marketing, you've got to have sales, all contributing to achieving a competitive cadence of new product introduction. Finally, I'd say the office of the CFO will contribute to timely product introduction with cost engineering intelligence and perhaps an understanding of product portfolio analysis as well and resource allocation based on risk and reward profile for each product that they have under development, a break-even point for recovering their development costs. So we've seen some people thinking about PLM really, you know, in the past, it used to be thought of just engineering. It's not really, it's an enterprise system now. And, you know, perhaps it's because I'm an old bean counter, but I think the CFO ought to be having some kind of, you know, something to do with this as well. And there could be involvement from corporate counsel too in protecting IP and managing consequential loss contingencies with suppliers and establishing channel partner agreements, all that kind of thing. So to me, it feels like PLM for a manufacturer sits in the middle of all of this. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, no, absolutely, George. And, you know, I think, you know, I really kind of share your view broadly in this. And, you know, to me, when we talk about getting products to market faster, it's really about helping drive top line or driving profitability, you know, and ultimately reducing risk as well. But it really
really why I talk about portfolio analysis, because you know this, if you've ever been developing things, someone's always coming along and going, when you're going to be finished? To which the answer is, well, when you give me enough resources to get it done. And that's another thing about PLM, of course, is it will tell you when you're going to be finished. You don't have, you know, your boss can see that. They don't have to keep asking you. Sorry, please keep going.
No, you're right, George. And really it is interesting because I do think ultimately kind of this getting to market faster is fundamentally about dollars and cents. And I know that the ROI calculator that you helped develop, I think really can help folks see that for their own enterprises as well. You know, and other couple of the thoughts I have on this, George, is that, you know, as you know, for a lot of engineering teams today, there's just so much data that, and sometimes the data, while it can be a huge asset, can also kind of really get in the way. And it ultimately, to be successful and to get these products out, we have to make decisions faster. And that really getting our products out on time and continuing to accelerate that is about how the company kind of from soup to nuts can really work across a common data set and really help enrich that data set to allow that product to launch faster. And, you know, when you're working in kind of legacy environments where that data is really siloed, and it's hard to collaborate, with that product data, it's really hard to move faster. Now, you mentioned cloud, George, as well today. And I think that for the cloud-based solutions, you know, PLM and others, it really is the best way for folks to drive that collaborative environment, whether you're across your enterprise or even out with your supply base as well.
I think that's what's driven the move to cloud, that and the fact that if you're going to manage all that data and drive any intelligence out of it, you need elastic storage and elastic compute. And Absolutely. Nobody, no traditional, let's say, IT person really wants to be doing that.
Yeah, and 100%. And ultimately, that to me is an important precursor to allow you to actually take advantage of AI. That if you're, you know, ultimately, if for AI to be effective, you have to have access to that data. And typically getting the data out of your on-prem solutions is going to be incredibly difficult. And I think fundamentally, therefore, that AI is going to be the catalyst, which finally does the death knell for all of those legacy on-prem solutions? You know, kind of based on our estimates, we think, George, I'm curious your reaction to this, but you know, I think in the next 2 to 3 years, 50% or more of those solutions are going to, and I guess it's consistent with your data, George, you know, they're going to look to move. And frankly, 5 years from now, I think, you know, it's done. I just think that the time is now finally for those solutions those companies need to start moving to those modern solutions.
Well, as you can see, the data said 46% of them are looking. Now, how long will it take them to look and make a decision? It depends on the pressure that's on them. And there's a lot of pressure on manufacturers now. There's pressure. Yeah, obviously, you know, we know all this stuff about inflation and we know all this stuff about shortages and difficulty in finding the right labor. And one of the ways that you get around that is that you make the labor you have better equipped. And you, to your point about data, you know this, the people who are engineers or designers, they have lots of their own data as well. They always have a desktop thing that's what used to be called product data management. They've always got loads of their own extensions. I think one of the things that really helps is if you can somehow bring that into the platform itself, is the platform has sufficient extensibility, has the, let's say, AI embedded UI or AI assisted UI, then that is going to help to bring that under enterprise control and not to the, to your point, to the silos that they have themselves, which I've seen, you know, people in the same office have different data. So, sitting next to each other.
All of the under the desk servers that have been running engineering departments for decades.
Yeah.
So maybe shifting, George, a little bit towards AI, you know, of course, you know, you can't run across more than two or three people before someone brings up AI and kind of its impact for the future. You've obviously been covering manufacturing for many years. You've been in manufacturing before that. What do you think is the greatest risk for manufacturers as they think about AI? And of course, you know, if thoughts about mitigation for those risks as well.
Well, it's funny, one of my colleagues calls AI stats on steroids, which I think is sort of true. But the risk is that people generally look for the answer, not a range of answers with different probabilities, which is really how life actually is. And actually, statistics and AI can yield you that range of answers. I mean, that's one of the really nice things about generative AI, that you can get lots of different answers. But there's risk, of course, for cybersecurity and personal data, not to mention falling foul of European legislation about something called ethical AI. But from my point of view, there's an issue really around data. You can train AI to screen data for quality, and that's good. You talked about lots and lots of data, so it can help to manage with that and for effectiveness for the purpose. But my worry is that in the selection and preparation of the data, the labeling of that data, you might hopelessly invalidate the results of the clever stats and calculations that are really in there. And there's also the question of, I suppose, data relevance. Are we looking at an answer that draws on the whole market-wide data or economy-wide data? How do we contextualize that for our company's specific problems and decisions? And I suppose the best mitigation for that risk is to spend time with early adopters and then how they matured in applying AI. In most enterprises, demand management and pricing function have been using AI actually to inform decisions for years now. So there might be something to learn from them. So I think those are some of the things that you might think about. Our clients tell us you might need also to rethink processes that make use of automation tools like AI. One of our interviewees said something which really struck in my head. She said, USA projects are capital U, capital S, and little a, understand, simplify, and then automate. Mm-hmm. So I think it's risky if you automate things that aren't necessarily well understood and haven't been simplified.
Yeah. Garbage in equals garbage out, right? We've axiom for many years.
There is one funny thing that we found. We asked people, do they prefer to negotiate with buyers or with a bot, and they said they preferred an AI infused bot for negotiation. Isn't that interesting?
It is. Well, I I think sometimes my my customers and some of my salespeople might be bots themselves. So anyway.
Not to give them any kind of bad ideas about what to do with your salespeople.
That's right. That's right. So George, you know, I concur that really the safeguarding of the data, especially for manufacturers and our product data, is really the key for our manufacturers to truly embrace AI. And of course, it's not about locking us away someplace and keeping it kind of under lock and key. To actually be able to take advantage of AI, you have to securely access that data to move forward. And that's why I think, you know, kind of open solutions like ChatGPT, while they're super interesting to, you know, to ask in our personal lives, I think in the world of business and for manufacturers, kind of that public, putting your product data in a public domain is a pretty scary proposition. I don't see many of our customers kind of moving to that. So you really have to have this ability that you can trust your data sources. You know, and I, George, was at Salesforce's annual conference last month called Dreamforce. And, you know, it was all about AI. Everywhere you turned, it was everything about AI. And, you know, the smart thing I think Salesforce is doing is whenever they talk about it, they're talking about it, the trusted AI solution. And so their view that they have kind of a closed loop ecosystem that they're intending to manage on how they think about how they're providing those AI solutions to customers. And I think that's really setting the bar for how all software providers that service these types of customers, I think how we all will have to think about this idea that the data must be, of course, it must be trustworthy, but also has to be secure. And that as we do that, you know, I think we'll see more and more manufacturers really kind of jump on this AI journey as they move forward.
Yeah, I think you're right.
All right, great. So let's pivot here a bit, George. So, you know, and obviously you're across the pond today and most days, and we're, I, and I think a lot of our audience today is in North America. So what are some of the outside, you know, the other factors you see that will have the most impact here on North American kind of U.S. manufacturing? And especially, you know, we talked a bit about, obviously, high tech is seeing a bit of a renaissance here, some of the high tech manufacturing. I'm kind of curious kind of how you see what some of those factors are at play for those manufacturers.
Well, it's interesting because we're just doing some research now, what we call Goldilocks manufacturing, which is about what might be the impact, for example, of all the geopolitical and non-tariff disruption on where is manufacturing going to take place? What's the optimal, let's say, balance between offshore, nearshore, and onshore, hence why we're calling it Goldilocks. But we talked already a bit about the challenges with the semiconductor market. We talked about those chip shortages that will disrupt plans to deploy advanced technologies. But we've also looked at mitigating strategies, including buying used semiconductors, adapting configurations to available components. And in my discussions with clients, I noticed the route to market for semiconductors is usually quite a sort of opaque web of multi-echelon distributors. I think there's a fantastic opportunity to use AI to clarify that. And one solution step would be to encourage more transparency about component availability before you start any kind of design. So then, of course, you know, you've had the US CHIPS Act that's allocated a lot of money, $54 billion, I think, in funding to support domestic technology innovation. I mean, that's beginning to come on stream now. So I think one of the things that I think is going to have a big impact will be the cost of energy, because manufacturing is extremely energy intensive. And so there'll be, you can already see what people are doing around green steel and activities like that. I think that will mean perhaps that some more manufacturing will come on shore. And some of the work we've done around different types of manufacturing technologies. So particularly, I'd say with 3D printing, we're seeing people, you know, most manufacturing is about heating things up and applying pressure to them. This is very energy intensive. But we're seeing some very smart things around chemistry, around, for example, releasing molecular energy between the layers that you lay down in 3D in 3D printing, so that you're substituting a different type of energy. So one of the interesting things, as always, people are rising to the, I think, rising to the challenge.
Yeah, that's great. And yeah, I think, you know, George, I've seen not only the CHIPS Act, but, you know, several of the other kind of recent U.S. legislation kind of really driving investment, not only in tech, but kind of other manufacturing. And I recently hosted a roundtable with a number of executives in California. It was 8 different manufacturing companies representing a number of different disciplines. And 8 of 8 manufacturers were bringing some portion to all manufacturing, either to nearshore or onshore. So to me, it's a really interesting trend here, as we're seeing.
Well, you know, PLM has an incredible role to play in this.
Oh, I mean, for sure.
If you think about it, an internal combustion engine car has 30,000 parts. An EV has 3,000 parts.
Yeah.
And this struck me a lot years ago when I was a controller, and the factory where I was in, we had an immense number of fasteners, you know, nuts and bolts and washers, and we always had the wrong ones. And when I started to investigate this, what's going wrong? Why can't we ship our orders because we haven't got the right washers? And it was because of the way that PLM worked, that PLM and sourcing really was driving supply chain. And sourcing had told the designers, design small piece parts, then we can go out all over the world and find the lowest unit cost. And that's exactly what we did, and brought all these little parts in and assembled them, by the way, almost in the center of London, and then sent stuff out all over the world. Crazy. Just crazy. Now, lots of people are not doing that now. They're saying, yeah. And, you know, every time you make a hole in something, you're induced stress. You make sure it's going to break more easily. Why not make the whole thing? So you see that definitely, for example, with igniters and gas turbines. People are making the whole thing in 3D printing rather than assembling it from pieces. More robust. It withstands the temperatures better. Seeing a lot of ceramics, you know, to help with that kind of thing.
Yep. Well, and if Elon Musk can ever get his cyber truck out here, you know, that kind of that whole single panel for the core chassis of the truck here. So
yes,
fascinating, yes. Fascinating stuff going on. Hey, George, we've got, I've got a bunch more questions for you, but there's a number queuing up from the audience here. So let's go over to some of those here. So the first one I have is from George Peters. And George asks, or initially states, but then asks, one of the major issues I've seen in PLM use is integration with ERP for commercial fulfillment in global markets. Often, consistency between PLM and ERP data keeps products locked up in customs at airport with pro forma invoice bombs not matching kind of what's in the box.
Yeah.
Where do you see data ownership best reside? In engineering? For the design and manufacturing, or more on the commercial side for the, you know, on the shipment and invoicing, where does that handoff best take place?
I'd say that we're seeing the most advanced of our users have a federated approach to this. And, you know, forever the data in ERP has been, not effective for customs declarations. And I hope this will be written on my heart when I die. I spent, 4 weeks with the customs and excise people here on validating systems. Where is this data actually coming from? Yes, I know it's in ERP, but who's maintaining it? And, you know, now sometimes I work with consumer goods manufacturers. I go to their warehouses. There's always somebody weighing and measuring boxes when they come in, cases, I should say. I go, why are you doing that? Because the data they sent us was wrong. Yeah, so, you know, there's some data which definitely needs to be mastered by the people who are creating the product, by engineering. And now sometimes it's going to, for example, jet engines. You like to think a jet engine is made as it's designed, not a bit of it. If you go and watch it, people are wrestling things into place. Every one of them is actually different. So that's why you need federated data. You need an as designed, as built, as maintained, and then an accountant's view. Which is, what's the cost of this? That's more what's going to be. So it ought to be mastered in PLM. And then perhaps in ERP, you might have some elements of the as manufactured if you're capturing it from MES and putting it there. But most PLMs manage that as well, and also as maintained.
Yeah, and I know, George, I was just I'm traveling this week on the U.S. East Coast, and just with a customer yesterday, and we were discussing the advantages they have of their integrating their PLM data to their ERP data, and their desire, what they want to do next is then get all their websites and their distributor network plumbed in with a PIM solution, so that PLM, ERP, and all the commercialization engines are all tied to the same product master, and being able to have kind of that single source of truth for the product they view is going to really untap for them a lot of future benefit as they're moving forward.
It doesn't help, of course, that sometimes the ERPs are not sufficiently flexible to manage all the data elements that you need. So even just for cost engineers, I talked about the CFO and doing cost engineering. Some of them are going, yeah, but we don't have the elements in ERP to do it. So, yeah, and so you're seeing some PLMs sort of stealing some of that stuff. So,
and we're seeing some of our customers, Georgia, who are bringing back that information and then the ability, kind of leveraging kind of core technology and PLM with kind of revision control to leverage kind of that type of core modality to be able to bring in cost data and to kind of model future or previous and future costs as you're considering design changes. So, George, I think we probably have time for one more audience question here. And then, by the way, I appreciate we've had a number of great questions come in. We'll get back to anyone who asked a question in email if we couldn't get to it here live. But there's Calvin Can, George, asked a question. He says, George, do you have any specific instances of companies that are already using AI to leverage PLM data, or probably AI more broadly, kind of in PLM, or is this still more future state?
I do, but I think it's confidential. I was afraid someone would ask me, oh, what are they doing it for? How much should they pay?
Could you maybe generalize the use case that you could describe it?
Yeah. Let me have a think about that, Carl. I might come back and say something in writing for you.
Okay, that's fair enough. I appreciate that. Yeah, and I would say what I'm most of the companies that I talk to are still in kind of pilot or beta mode here. But right now, it's folks who are looking to kind of leverage across masses of data to form insights. So I know one of the use cases, leveraging through component databases, different component shortages or component quality issues, to being able to assess that, kind of the mass of part data and bounce it against your bill of material, and being able to assess kind of risk of your assembled product by some of the risk of the parts.
Actually, I can think of two examples. They're both European automotive manufacturers. And for them, what they've been doing, part of their validation is the crash dummy test. There's a mass of sensor data on those crash dummies, and they've been using AI to mine that and to provide guidance to the design process. In particular, this is around, what happens when there's, some kind of impact on the vehicle. So how should you design the cage? And they're using AI to help them, first of all, absorb all that data, but to put it into the beginning of the design process and not right at the end, so that they, because, you've got many more options for change at the beginning than you have at the end. So that's an example. There's two companies I can think that are doing that. There's probably hundreds more, but two that I know.
I think the number of things under consideration currently far exceeds those actually in production, but it'll be interesting to see kind of which of these kind of pilots and betas people start to really drive value from and learn from and continue to build upon, which to me is kind of the core idea here, is that we're on this huge learning curve. The software capability is one piece of it. Well, then it's really, what are the insights you get from the AI, and is it ultimately valuable for you or not? Does it actually help you drive better business decisions? Can you leverage those insights to actually affect an outcome?
I just thought of another one, which was actually in aerospace.
Enough time, George, you're going to get a bunch of them.
No, it's just come to me. This one was one in aerospace. And the particular part, they were running in silico testing. What will this part be like in how many, hundreds of hours of flight will it give you? And the AI suggested, actually, this part is not sufficiently strong, so you need to make it thicker. It then was able to detect it won't fit on the robot, and by the way, it probably won't fit out of the doors of the factory either. So then it was able to help suggest an alternate material. So don't use that material, use this material. You don't have to make it so thick. It will fit into the robot that's going to machine it, and it'll still get out of the doors of the factory. So that was another example that popped up.
That's a great one. Well, I want to thank, first of all, George, you for your insights here and additional kind of thoughts afterwards. And thank the audience for tuning in for this. We will, so for folks who are interested, you know, please reach out to us. And, although I don't believe we can share, the exact content that George provided, we can provide some video links here to the presentation. So you can replay this as we go. And again, to the people that asked additional questions, we will get back to you offline with some of our thoughts. So thank you, everybody. Appreciate you tuning in. George, have a good evening there in UK, and a good day to everyone here else.
Thank you.
Thanks,
everyone.
Thank you for listening to The Platform Rules, Digital Transformation for Product Companies. You can listen to this show and more at propelsoftware.com/podcasts. If you enjoyed what you heard, please share with a colleague, leave a review, or email us at podcast@propelsoftware.com with any feedback or questions. Until next time, Platform Rules.